Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's taking a break this week, but she'll be back with us next week. We have a really fun book today. Well, it's fun if you like psychological suspense, domestic drama types of books, which I do. Our guest today is Stacy Wise, and Stacy is the award-winning author of the novels Beyond the Stars and Maybe Someone Like You. And the book we're talking about today is Lie, Lie Again. Prior to her writing career, Stacy worked in television casting on shows including The X-Files, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and Party of Five. After a decade in the industry, she returned to school and received her teaching credential and master's from Chapman University, and she has taught both kindergarten and third grades. She's a native of California and a graduate of UCLA and lives with her family and three fluffy dogs in LA. And it's funny, when I'm reading this, all this biographical information, there's an awful lot of this that kind of shows up in Lie, Lie Again. So welcome to Writers' Voices, Stacy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
So Lie, Lie Again is set in California. There are certainly some nice dogs. There's a kindergarten teacher. I think she's kindergarten. I can't remember for sure. But anyway, elementary school teacher.
Elementary school teacher, yeah.
And but there's some other things that probably aren't too true to your life.
No. A lot is not true to my life at all, but it was very fun to write.
I bet. Now, your earlier books were young adult books, if I'm not mistaken.
They weren't young adult books. Those are more geared toward teenagers. So this was a category called new adult, which, if I'm not mistaken, kind of replaced the term chick lit in the publishing world.
Okay.
So the protagonists are in their 20s and sort of discovering who they are and what their place in the world is and things like that. So, but new adult is definitely also very heavily found in the romance world as well. So I don't even know if they call it new adult anymore, to be honest. They're always changing things in the publishing world. But I would call them, you know, it's sort of romantic comedies for people in their 20s or featuring people in their 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Lie, Lie Again is a little different.
It is, yes. Yes, it's very different. I had never written a book with three main characters before, all from different points of view. So that was definitely a challenge, but a fun challenge.
And also there is certainly romance and maybe a little bit of comedy, but really more drama in this one.
Yeah, I would say if there's comedy, it's more dark humor where someone might chuckle, but it's also kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah. So the thing that I found really interesting about it is that there is sort of a villain, but she's not all bad.
Oh, I'm glad you feel that way. That was the goal, was to make her relatable, but yet you question why does she do what she does, but then you kind of find yourself rooting for her. At least that was my goal.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, people are complex and people aren't all bad or all good. And all of the characters, your three main female characters in this book, are people who you can sympathize with in one way or another. And they do some really good things and they do some kind of not so good things. One of them's pretty much all good and one of them leans more towards the bad. And then one's sort of right in the middle.
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
I think it just sort of fleshed out as I was writing it. So I didn't go in with that intention, but the character sort of led me down that road, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And now the men, on the other hand, don't really show up quite as what would you say, quite as well. This is, it wasn't so sympathetic with any of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because there were some male characters in there who I thought were really nice, likable human beings.
Yes. Yeah. They aren't bad. They weren't all bad. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Right. Like Sal, for example, was just an all around very nice person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
But some of the main men, yes, showed up with a very negative light around them. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how is writing this book different than, you said, you know, it's the first time you wrote a book from three points of view, you know, three main characters, three different points of view. But how else, in terms of your writing process, how was this different or not?
It was different. I definitely had to, oh my goodness, now that I'm going back and thinking about this, I had a big poster board that I had different colored post-its that I mapped out on it, and each post-it reflected a different character, because I had to keep their stories separate yet intertwined. And so in order to sort of make sure their timelines were all lining up, which sometimes got tricky, I really had to have a visual of that. So that was very different. Before, in my writing, everything was very, very linear and told from one person's perspective in the first person. So, yeah, this presented a little bit more of a challenge. And I did find myself using a lot of visuals to get through it. One of my friends is someone who does a lot of vision boarding. And she said, oh, let's try this out. Let's make a vision board for your characters. So I did that early on, and I found that to be really, really fun. So I would just cut pictures out of magazines and put them under each specific character that sort of reflected who they were or things they might do. So that was really an interesting task that became kind of fun. But it helped me see what the characters were, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it sure does. And it's interesting, though, because you definitely, it seemed to work, because there was definitely a difference between the three characters, that there wasn't any time where I was confused which one was you were writing from, which point of view you were writing from. So I think you were very successful in that.
Oh, good. Thank you. I'm glad that worked out.
Yeah.
You always wonder, once your book's out there, what are people thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of the characters really seemed very fully formed of those three women. They all, like I said, you could sympathize or empathize with all of them and were rooting for all of them. And it's not like they were always on the same side of everything either.
So you
can see both, you know, see Ricky's point of view and Embry's point of view when, you know, things were a little, yes, they were friends, but there was, I don't want to give too much away, but there was a little jealousy going on there, and you could understand both of them.
Oh, good. Yeah. I definitely worked hard to sort of dive into how Ricky was feeling and how she was also feeling very guilty in some ways.
Yes. Yeah.
But also it was almost like an obsession with her that she didn't know how to get rid of. And so I wanted to show her really struggling through that, because I think oftentimes people in their 20s, they're really trying to find their footing and trying to find out who they are and what motivates them and what kind of person they want to be out in the world. And I really wanted Ricky to represent all of that, because I find that fascinating. I mean, I look back at my 20s and I thought that I knew everything, and yet I struggled a lot of the time, you know, trying to find my footing and where I fit in and all that.
Yeah, well, for me, that was so long ago, I don't really remember. But because I, you know, had kids really young, it was like one of your characters did, but in some ways it was, made it.
You grew up fast.
Yeah, I grew up really fast. And also it wasn't a time, you know, because of my age, which I won't tell you exactly, but I am a little probably older than you. And it wasn't a time where women really had a lot of options. We were, you know, kind of geared towards you become a secretary, a teacher, or a nurse if you want a career. And just getting out of that, I was at the point in time where women were starting to break out of that. So I probably didn't have the mixed feelings that maybe a young woman today who starts a family really early feels like she's sacrificing something career-wise. And I was very fortunate then to be able to build a very successful career after having had my kids, after they were in school, and not being behind the game at all.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how things have changed and progressed, isn't it?
Right. And I'm very happy that women have a lot more options now and that, you know, careers can take so many different directions. You're not so limited. It's a great thing. But you do then, if you decide to have children, you want to have children and you want to take time out from a career to do that, it can be challenging. It can be difficult.
Absolutely.
To ever catch up again. And we're certainly seeing this during this pandemic in particular, where so many women have been called upon to take care of their kids who can't go to school. And it's affecting their careers, their jobs. And as usual, the burden tends to fall on the women, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It's so interesting that you say that, because I remember when I was teaching and I found out I was pregnant with my first daughter. I have four kids. And my grandmother said, don't leave your job. Take your maternity leave and go right back to work. And I said, I don't know if I can do that. I think I want to stay home with my kids. And she was very adamant about it. And my grandma was a very, very strong woman and very much a feminist. And we kind of argued about it. And I think in her mind, she thought, you know, we fought so hard for women to be in the workplace. Don't stay home with your kids. And I thought, oh my gosh, work will always be there. I have to stay home with my kids. And that's what I ended up doing. I stayed home with all of them and I found a career that would work for me to stay at home. And it turned out that it was exactly what I've always wanted to do, which is right. But it's so interesting, just the individual struggles that women go through throughout their lives in terms of balancing that work and their life and raising children and all of that.
You know, they say you can't have it all, but I feel like you can, just not necessarily all at the same time.
Yep, I think that's true. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah, and it can be difficult to kind of catch up career-wise, but it's not impossible. And as you have shown, you know?
Yeah, I think so. And it is a struggle. I mean, you know, writing is a long journey. It's not an overnight. I mean, a lot of times we see people and they look like these big overnight successes. But if you dig deeper, you can see, oh my gosh, that person was writing for 20 years before they became an overnight success or something like that.
Yes,
you
exactly.
You know, there's always the, what's the rest of the story behind that?
Yeah. So you started writing after your children were born.
Yes, I started writing when my son, who's my youngest, he's 11 now, but I think he was 3 or 4. I remember he was in preschool and, you know, I always wanted to write. And when I was a casting director, we always had hiatus, which means we took time off while, I don't know what, why did we take time off? Anyway, the show went down and we would have 3 months off. And I always found myself trying to write during that time. And I would try to write, you know, screenplays or episodic television. I worked in episodic television, so I had read so many scripts and I felt like I was so well versed in that. And everything I wrote was awful, so awful that I would put it in hidden files on my computer. So if anything ever happened to me and someone looked at my computer, they wouldn't find it.
So, like,
it was bad. And so But I was always drawn to that, and I was always a voracious reader. And finally, when I, oh gosh, my son was in preschool, and my neighbor across the street brought over all of the Twilight books and said, read these. And I said, I'm not really into vampires. And she said, I don't care, read them anyway. And so, of course, I did, and I loved them. And then I started researching more about Stephanie Meyer and who she was and all that. And I came across a story or an interview that she had done where she said that she told herself stories all day long. Like that's what she did to pass the time. Or if she was in the car and she would see something, her mind just automatically started making up a story about what was going on. And she said, you know, like everybody does. And the interviewer said, yeah, we don't all do that. And I thought, oh my gosh, I do. I do that. And so I don't know. There was a story in my mind at the time. And I thought, why not? I have nothing to lose. I can just start writing this while the kids are all in school. And I came across two other moms in my neighborhood who were also writers, and we formed a critique group. And then one day we said, you know what? Like, let's really do this. Let's figure this out. Let's figure out how we can, you know, find agents and write query letters and do all of it. And we did all of that together. And that was one of the most amazing experiences, because it was three moms totally supporting each other, cheering each other on, and succeeding together. And it was so amazing. And we're still together to this day, which is so great. And we all write different genres.
And are all three of you published?
Two of us are, and one of us is not yet, but fingers crossed that that'll happen for her soon.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. In fact, one of my critique partners' third books is coming out this month, and it's called A Shot at Normal. And it's so timely. She wrote this before the pandemic started, but it's about the struggle of a teenage girl who wants to be vaccinated, but her parents are staunch anti-vaxxers. So it's such a lovely story and so timely. So I'm really, really thrilled for her that it's coming out in this time.
What a great concept.
Right?
Yeah. You know, I could kind of empathize a little bit. When I was a kid, my parents were not like other parents. And, you know, looking back, that was a good thing. But at the time, you know, my dad was really into health food, and we did not have the diet that my friends had, and I didn't have the clothes that my friends had. And there used to be this joke, I don't even know where it came from, about something about my mother wore army boots, and I don't know if I'd tell this if mom was with us today, because normally, you know, my mother is my co-host, but my mother had these L.L. Bean boots that were like these big, clunky, looked like army boots. And this was in the, you know, 60s and 70s. So this was not kind of normal mom dress. And, you know, we ate yogurt and granola when nobody even knew what that was, you know, where you had to go to a special little store that was tucked away in the, you know, just this tiny little store to even buy yogurt. Which is,
oh my gosh.
I know, it's unthinkable now. You go into every supermarket in America and there is as much
shelves of
yogurt as these entire health food stores were.
Yeah.
I mean, the entire health food store was the size of the yogurt shelves now, practically. And so, you know, there were times when I just wanted to be like other kids. And not eat steamed soybeans in the shell, which now is edamame, you know, but back then it was like this weird thing. You really had to work for your dinner to shell all these soybeans in order to eat them.
Wow. So you actually might really relate to this book that she wrote, because
that's this
girl's life. It's all homegrown, and like she's never been to Starbucks before, and she looks at it, you know, longingly.
Oh, and we went to a restaurant exactly once in my childhood. One time.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That is so interesting. And now, do you still eat super healthfully, or did you stray from that?
I strayed from it even then. I had candy hidden in my closet. I'd go to the corner candy store every dime I had, and that was when you could really buy something with a dime. But no, I have a relatively healthy diet, but I'm not extreme. And also, the mainstream caught up with our diet, really. Like I said, yogurt. Everybody eats yogurt and granola now, and
I was going to say, that's a staple in my diet. I love that.
And so mostly, and I do try and eat mostly whole foods, not
Yes.
necessarily from whole foods, but not non-processed foods. And but I stay away from the extreme health food crazes now because I had enough of them when I was a kid.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I also think everything in balance. I think if we restrict ourselves from a certain thing and label it bad, then we want it even more. So, I try to
For
do that with
sure.
my kids. I'm like, if you want ice cream, have ice cream, but be reasonable about it. Don't eat the whole cart,
Yeah, I'm perfectly happy with I get the smallest bowls I can find when I have ice cream. They're like little teeny bowls. And if you fill them up, it looks like you're eating a lot,
Oh,
even
that's
when you're not.
interesting. Oh, and that's my favorite treat. I just love ice cream so much.
Well,
I
that
really do.
even that was in your book.
Oh my gosh, that's right. Yes, Sylvia was having her cone. That's
Yes,
right.
yeah,
Yes.
yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting what little things from my own life will go in there. And I think some of it's just my likes and dislikes. But yet, it's so far from a normal day in my life.
I
Does that make
certainly hope
sense?
so. Yes, I hope so.
And I think, like, Sylvia, for example, came to mind so fully fleshed out, and her voice was very loud in my head and very demanding. So sometimes I would be picking my kid up from school, or one of my kids from school, and I would literally pray that, the pickup line would be long so I could just talk into my phone real quick and jot down some notes because I never knew when she would show up.
Oh, interesting. You're listening
Yeah.
to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Stacey Wise, author of Lie, Lie Again. So that's how you use a recorder?
Only under duress. Only
Okay.
if I have nothing else. If I'm in the car or something and I have a brilliant idea that I may throw away later, but I've started talking into my notes section of my phone. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And what about
Although,
other kinds of note taking? Do you like keep a little notebook with you at all times to jot things down?
I used to. I don't do that so much anymore just because it's so easy to talk into my phone. But I did listen to an interview with James Patterson that was so fascinating. It was one of his master classes. But he was saying your good ideas, you always think they're going to disappear, but they always come back to you in one form or another if you just listen. And that's such good advice. I used to have such fear of losing my brilliant ideas or ideas that I thought were brilliant at the time. But the really good ones, the ones that are going to end up in the book, they always come back, even if you think they're gone. Those midnight, oh, I'm too tired to write this down. I'll remember it in the morning, and in the morning it's gone. But then, 3 days later, if it's actually an idea worth keeping, it'll pop back up mysteriously. So
I never thought about that, but that's kind of a comfort, isn't it?
I think once I heard, James Patterson, who's written so many books and had such a great career, once I heard him say, oh, don't worry about that, I thought, wow, if James Patterson doesn't waste his time worrying about that, maybe I should.
Right. Well, Stacy, do you want to read a little bit from Lie Lie again?
Sure, I would love to. I'd be happy to. Let
Great.
me see. All right, you want me to just dive right in?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. After Monday, March 20th, sirens shattered the cool evening air with a piercing wail that rivaled a speed metal concert. The bright lights of emergency vehicles spun dizzying circles through the sky, a frantic dance to the ear-splitting dissonance. Brakes squealed and doors slammed. The sirens screamed to a stop at the apartment complex on Mockingbird Lane, and the night seemed to exhale. Emergency workers streamed from the truck with rapid efficiency, their medical kits and blue latex gloves ready to work miracles. Only the onlookers, who wore the slack-jawed expressions of those who had seen a ghost, stood rooted to the ground, seemingly frozen in time, unable to look away from the body splayed face down on the asphalt. Sylvia stood between Ricky and Embry, her arms crossed loosely at her chest. Their small semicircle was casual, like spectators at a parade. Well, a body at the bottom of the stairs is sure to draw a crowd. Let me start with chapter one before, Sunday, March 5th. The world news section of the Sunday paper was spread across Hugh's otherwise pristine kitchen table. Sylvia dutifully skimmed the headlines. Casualties, crisis, corruption. Why couldn't they report good news? It seemed that paper sales would go up if they splashed uplifting headlines across the front page. She sipped her coffee and enjoyed the bittersweet tang of the powdered creamer she'd added. Hugh had introduced her to the chemical concoction. She'd initially mocked it, but now she was obsessed. Too much was probably deadly. She laughed to herself. The dreary news was clearly taking a toll, doom and gloom. As much as she enjoyed her Sunday mornings with Hugh, she could do without the newspaper bit. But he loved his old-fashioned ritual, the familiar smell, and his eventual inky fingers. Trendy frameless glasses were perched on the tip of his nose, his half of the paper in a tight fold. Such a serious man. She liked that she had the power to make him smile. He was absolutely perfect in an everyday man sort of way. It was one of the things that made him so desirable. Would he be insulted by the everyday man comment if she were to say it aloud? Words were funny. It was all too easy to misinterpret things when you weren't privy to the vast array of thoughts in the other person's head. She studied him as he read, dark blonde hair, cool gray-blue eyes beneath the glasses. His lashes were stubby. There was really no nice way to say it, but on a man, stubby lashes weren't so bad, were they? They were thick and full and gave him an assertive look, a reliable look, like he'd be the one to give you tax advice or walk you through the process of setting up a wireless remote. Yes, everything about him was steadfast and sturdy. Hugh was the Volvo of men. She laughed to herself. He certainly wouldn't like that analogy. The man drove a Range Rover. Meeting him had been a lucky fluke. He'd been wearing a wedding ring, and married men weren't her type. But he'd pulled up a bar stool next to hers at the Vertigo, and a conversation began to flow as smooth as the red wine she sipped. The lights in the bar were dim and golden, and unlike the name suggested, the place had a gentle old Hollywood feel. When she'd asked how long he'd been married, he laughed and slid off the ring. It's a fake. He proceeded to twist what she realized was cheap metal into a tiny infinity sign. Fake? Why? He'd leaned forward, eyes twinkling, and spoken quietly like he was letting her in on a secret. Well, it's not like I'm fighting off women, but I found that wearing a ring allows me to enjoy a drink without any weird vibes from a woman who thinks I'm hitting on her. Usually, I just want to talk. With a humble shrug, he added, I'm a people person. And with a wedding band, you're Mr. Safe Guy, not Mr. Slick. Right. He tucked the crumpled metal into his pocket. Does that make me sound crazy? His smile was genuine, and Sylvia found herself grinning back. She'd inspected his face. He had to be in his 30s, late 30s, so he couldn't be much older than her 35 years. Interesting that he was still single. We'll call it a unique approach. How's that? Fair enough. He'd lifted his drink to hers. I'm Hugh. Sylvia. As they'd clinked glasses, a sudden certainty had washed over her. After all the thinking and plotting and planning, he'd simply appeared in her path like a lucky penny. Later that night, in a dark corner of the Vertigo foyer, they'd pressed their bodies together and kissed like lovers. As she drove home alone, she'd laughed to herself, amused that she'd left the Vertigo with an acute case of vertigo because of Hugh. How long had it been since a kiss had left her dizzy? Truth be told, it wasn't because he was an extraordinary kisser, though he'd been perfectly acceptable in that department. the excitement had stemmed from Hugh's infinite potential as a partner. He would be the one to father her future child. The two of them would make a beautiful baby together, a smart one, too. The baby wanting was a fascinating new thing for Sylvia. When the calendar had landed on December 13th last year, quietly sliding her from 34 to 35, her biological clock had transformed from the steady tick of a metronome's beat into a freight train doing donuts off the track. It was unusual for her to want something so badly. Sure, she could hook up with some guy and get herself pregnant, but there was risk involved. Bad genes, for one. And she wasn't interested in a baby with a side of herpes. Her instincts had been right about Hugh. He was free of both. She smiled at him from across the table before returning her gaze to the headlines. One in the bottom corner caught her eye. Mad cow disease was found in a cow in San Diego, she read aloud. That'll do wonders for the meat industry. Huh? He adjusted his glasses and looked at her. Mad cow disease, she repeated. It says here that humans who consume the contaminated beef would be at risk for developing prion disease, which is blah, blah, blah. Ah, here, a degenerative brain disorder that can quickly disable or kill its victims. Well, that sounds delightful. Do you think the cows literally go mad? She chuckled, bumping into each other and mooing incoherently before they keel over. I mean, it's sad. It's kind of sad, but funny too. There's nothing funny about mad cow disease, though it's rare for humans to get it. If I recall correctly, they would have to consume infected tissue or some such. Sylvia smiled. It's rare. Do you see what you did there? He chuckled. Anyway, we should become vegetarians. Hugh thumped his paper to the table and slid off his glasses, awarding her with an amused look. We'll drink green juice and eat pounds of kale. A kitchen timer buzzed and he stood, or we can indulge in buttermilk biscuits. They're vegetarian and they're ready. You are a prince among men. I'll get the butter and jam. As she took the jam from Hugh's tidy refrigerator, her mind trailed to the cows. How could a cow go mad? They didn't deserve to suffer that way, though some humans she knew might. Well, even if Hugh thought she was joking, she was going to stop eating meat for the foreseeable future. Going mad by way of eating beef sounded dreadful. Sanity was something she treasured.
And that was Stacy Wise reading from the beginning of Lie, Lie Again. So one of the characters in this book is an actor, one of the husbands of the main characters. And so how much did your background as working in casting impact, you know, what you were writing about there with that character?
Probably a lot, in the sense that I could really sympathize with Brandon and his struggles to make it in Hollywood. I worked on, like I said, television shows, and all of the series regulars were in place. And so what we did was hire all of the guest stars. So each time there was, you know, a banker or a teacher or someone's best friend or things like that, those were the roles that we would cast. And some of those roles were big and some of those roles were really small. And so the newer actors would be the ones that would audition for those smaller roles. And I often would chat with them when they came in. I wanted to know, how long have you been doing this? Where did you come from? Because so many people I found had moved from all over the country to Los Angeles to pursue acting. And it always fascinated me to hear the things that they had done through, the mountains they had moved to just get here. And then to get the audition for something like a co-starring role, which to me was, you know, something that was relatively small in the scheme of things, but to them, getting their first co-starring role might have been the greatest thing that happened to them all year. So I really had to understand that when I was doing those auditions, to give that the attention that it deserved, if that makes sense. And I really empathized with the actors that came in, and I was always rooting for them. And I knew how passionately so many of them wanted it, and I knew how limited the space was. And so I think I really, I felt very supportive of the actors. That's one of the things I really loved doing, was helping them and maybe giving someone their very, very first job. So I do understand the struggle of what they went through.
And what is it that would make you as a cast, or I don't know if you actually made the decisions, but choose one person over somebody else?
So what I would do is I would do the pre-reads, which I don't even think they do those anymore. I think that's all done by having the actors put themselves on tape. So I would, you know, call an actor in through his agent or her agent, and they would read the sides, the audition scene. And if I liked them, I would send them to the producer session, which I would read with them again, but this time the producers and the director and the writer of the show would be there. And then collectively we would decide from that smaller pool which person got the job. And it was really just who embodied the role the best. And sometimes we would see, you know, a handful of actors, and whether it was the writer or a director who would say, you know, I feel like this role needs to go to a woman, not a man. Like, it's not working for me as a man. Let's switch it up. And so sometimes at the last minute, I would have to put out a call for somebody completely different than who I was initially looking for. But it was really just who embodies the role best and who moves the story forward best.
Did you ever have an actor like Brandon who was so good looking it just took your breath away?
Yes. I do. I remember this guy coming in, and I was young. I was, gosh, like probably 21 or 22, probably 22. And I think I froze. And he sat down right next to me because my boss had given him the part, and we had to fill out a deal memo together. And I was like blushing and I was sweating. And I thought, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. But he was just so handsome. I didn't even know what to do with myself. Yeah. But then I learned very quickly, like, okay, like, let's not do that ever again. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that someone like that, they may on some level be aware of it, but often they have as much insecurity as anyone else.
Well, the ironic thing is we became really close friends. And it almost became funny to us, but he was really legitimately a nice, humble human being, which was completely contrary to what I thought he would have been based on what he looked like, you know, but a very nice person, a good son, you know. And we're still in touch to this day. But yeah, we laugh the fact that I was like a mess when I first met him. Yeah.
Now, Ricky's the elementary school teacher.
Yes.
And you really get into some detail about the struggles that she's having as a teacher at a private school with, shall we call them helicopter parents? Getting way too, like, worked up about silly, silly things.
Yes.
Have you, as a teacher, did you have experiences like that?
To some extent, I do remember when I moved from teaching kindergarten to third grade, and I had just gotten married, and at back to school night, a mom came up to me and said, you're newly married, you're new to third grade, you're a new teacher, how are you going to present yourself as a good teacher in the classroom? And I was a little taken aback because everybody else had been so welcoming. And I just said to her, I would love for you to come and watch me teach any given day. Just pop in, go to the office, get your pass, come in, join us. You know, you're welcome to come in anytime. And she never bothered me again, but it was so like off-putting to her. You know, and it wasn't like she said it in a nice way. She was definitely in my face, sort of pointy. I thought that was interesting, but I think what inspired me more was when I was older and I had kids and I saw the things that other parents maybe did to the teachers of my own kids. How upset they would get over the littlest things. And I was always ready to defend the teacher because I was a teacher and I knew how hard we try, you know, and I'm like, this is not a big deal. This is really not a big deal. So of course it's very dramatized for the book, But I think a lot of it was definitely inspired by just looking around and seeing what was going on in my own neighborhood and how, whether it's on the soccer field or at dance class or whatever the case may be, just how things can escalate so quickly over something that really doesn't need to be that big of a deal. And I find that fascinating.
And it is absolutely true that sometimes a child will go home and say, oh, the teacher said such and such, but they're taking it out of context. And
right.
And next thing you know, the parent's getting all worked up about something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do remember one of my mentor teachers saying that she always told her teachers at back to school night, if you don't believe everything your child comes home and tells you, I won't believe everything they say that goes on at home. I thought that was so funny because it's true. Sometimes the kids would say things to me and I thought, wait, what? What did you just say? Sadly, there were cases where we did have to dig a little bit deeper, but, you know, about things that kids had said. But, you know, for the most part, it was just silly stuff.
Well, I can tell you one time my daughter, who is, you know, very much an adult now, but when she was about, I don't know, maybe 8, 9 years old or something, maybe younger, she was mad that I wouldn't let her do something. And she says, I'm going to call child abuse and report you.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And I'm going, you go right ahead.
Yes.
They report me for not letting you go somewhere.
Yeah. Reporting you for not letting you have an extra cookie. That's funny.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
But she did not follow through with her threat.
No, of course not. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, kids can be not always truthful either. That's for sure. And they can definitely misunderstand things.
Yes, they absolutely can.
So let's talk a little bit more about how you got your first book published. So you were in this group with your two mom friends.
Yes.
And you were starting to send out query letters and so forth. So how did it happen?
So I had read a lot online about writing query letters. There were so many good, helpful blogs and things like that, some done by agents, some done by other writers. One that I relied heavily on was the Query Shark. I don't think she does that any longer, but there were so many different query letter examples that you could read, and she would just go through them and critique them, which was super helpful to see how someone else's query letter was critiqued. And I had read that some people query 200 agents before they get one. And that just didn't feel right for me. I thought if I can't get an agent within like 35 query letters, then I may need to go back and redo it. And that's not the case for everybody. Some people may say 200 query letters is the right number for me. But for myself, it was 35. And so I didn't get an agent with my first book. And so I set it aside and I sat in front of my laptop and I stared at it. And I thought, I have nothing. I have nothing left to write. I don't have a story in my head. I'm completely empty. And I just forced myself to sit there. And I don't know if the TV was on in the background or what, but it must have been, because all of a sudden, I think I can visualize like a pig waving a little flag in a car. So it must have been like an auto insurance commercial that was on. And all of a sudden, the line in my head was, there was a pig in the passenger seat. And I knew immediately the story. That's the first line of the book, Beyond the Stars. And it was like miraculous. All of a sudden, the story started flooding in. And it was the story of a young girl who was the assistant to an actor, and it was not the job she wanted. And he owned a pet pig, and she was literally driving down the street with a pig in her car. And she was mortified by it. And so I finished that book. I think it took 9 months to write. And this time I queried a lot more carefully. I really researched each and every agent that I queried. And I started out with the agents that weren't at the tip top of my list. You know, I would have been thrilled to have them, but they weren't at the tip top of my list. And I started with those. And when they all wanted to see pages, then I went to my next grouping. And when they wanted pages, I was like, okay, maybe I can shoot for the stars and go to my tippity top agents. And by the grace of God, the name at the very top of my list requested my book and she signed me. And I have no idea how that happened, but there was one agent and I just kept sending mental vibes to her, like, you love my book, you love my book.
And
she's been such a champion. You know, when I said to her, I'm not writing, you know, new adult novels, or this next book isn't a new adult novel, I'm trying something really, really different. How do you feel about that? And she said, great, send whatever you want. And that, I mean, that just felt so supportive. And she's just been awesome. So I feel very, very lucky. But yeah, that's how that worked.
And then did she have an easy time placing that book, your first book?
I think it sold within like 6 months, maybe 8 months. It wasn't a super, June, July, August, September. It was 6 months, yeah, because I think we went out in June, and I remember wrapping Christmas presents when she told me that my editor wanted it. So yeah, it was placed pretty quickly. So that was exciting.
And who was the publisher?
For my first two books, I was with Entangled Publishing, which is mostly ebooks. That's what their sort of niche is. And they did do some print books, but it's mostly known for romance novels and ebooks.
Ah.
Yes.
So how is that? So they're not in bookstores that much, but how do they promote the books then?
A lot of online promotion. And Liz Petalier is the head of that company, and she definitely was or is a kind of like a pioneer in the whole ebook world, I would say. I feel like she does a really, really good job of reaching out to readers who like to devour ebooks. They keep the price point really low, so people don't feel like they're putting in a big investment. You know, they'll often have like 99 cent sales and things like that. Because I think also romance readers tend to literally devour books. You know, they'll just go. So I think it worked well for those first two books. And then, you know, with Lila Again, it was placed with Lake Union Publishing, which is under the Amazon umbrella, and they do print and E and Audible and the whole nine yards. And so that's been really fun. I didn't know how cool it would be to have someone like post a picture on Instagram of my book in an indie bookstore. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's so cool.
Oh, wow.
You know,
wow. So it's out on the shelves now?
It is. Yes. It came out January 1st. It was actually part of Amazon's first read. So it was available to Prime members in December. And then it came out worldwide January 1st.
So Amazon's first read, that's a Kindle program, right?
Yes, it's the Kindle program where Prime members can pick one of, I want to say, 8 books to download on their Kindle for free.
Yeah, that reminds me, I haven't done that for a few months. I used to get them every month, and I just sort of forgotten about it.
Oh, there's some really good choices for February, so you should take
good.
A look.
Okay.
Yeah,
I definitely will. So that must have really given the book a boost.
I think so. You know, it's hard to know exactly how it's doing from, you know, my little corner of the world. But I've gotten a ton of good feedback. So that's super exciting.
And how did you get selected for that?
I don't even know. I just got a call from what happened? My editor emailed both my agent and I and said, I have some good news. Let's do a conference call. And so I didn't want to wait. And I was at a horseback riding lesson with my daughter. And so I took a walk and I said, call now. And so I was out there walking through the, I don't know, hilly little area, and with a huge smile on my face, because I was so excited. It's such an honor. And I had always been a fan of the Amazon First Brief programs anyway, just as a reader. So that was super, super exciting.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's sort of like, in some ways, as good as getting on the New York Times bestseller list.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe, yeah. Amazon's got pretty long arms, right? They got
right.
A big reach.
Yeah.
So it's been really fun. And I really adore my editor as well. She's been so great to work with. And all of Lake Union Publishing has been just wonderful. So, this one's been super fun.
So, you've worked in episodic television, and it does seem like there's a trend in like miniseries of this type of story. Has anyone approached you about that?
Not yet. Readers have. A lot of readers have said, I can't wait to see this on the big screen. And I'm like, do you know something I don't know? That would be really cool. And it's funny, someone, I don't know who said it on Instagram, but my old assistant in casting, he's a casting director now. He does a ton of stuff. And I jokingly said, like, you can cast it if it gets made into a, you know, Netflix series. And he was like, yes, I said yes. It was cute. But I haven't heard anything, but, you know, if it did get picked up, that'd be awesome. I think it would work well as that, because it's definitely got a very dramatic, soapy, fun feel to it. But who knows?
I think it would be perfect for Reese Witherspoon's production company.
Oh, I love Reese Witherspoon. I think she's fabulous.
Yeah, and she has her own production company, and I think that this is, would be right up her alley.
Saying. If anybody's listening who knows Reese.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, she's done some great things. She really has. It's amazing. And I still remember her as the little girl that was on that movie, The Man in the Moon. Do you remember that from so long ago?
Oh my.
She's like done so well for herself in so many different ways. I'm always like, go Reese. It's great. But yeah, that would be really cool.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Stacy Wise, author of Lie, Lie Again. Now, I'm going to guess that you are writing another book now.
I am, yes. I am. And I had written a book, gosh, I think I started it before Lie, Lie Again even sold. And I really loved so many of the characters in it, but it wasn't gelling. It wasn't going where I wanted it to go. And I set it aside, and I took one tiny little plot point, not even plot point, one tiny idea, a little nugget from that. And I started writing a new book, and it's really been flowing, and I'm so excited about it. It's called Things We Hold Dear, and it's the story of unlikely friendship, and also the story of how a mother will stop at nothing to protect her child. And so it's one of those books where I hope at the end people go, very heartwarming. And I think a lot of why I switched gears from what I was doing before to this was simply because of the pandemic. And there was a lot of, you know, sadness around me because of people getting sick and, you know, my own kids feeling stuck in the house and homeschooling and missing their friends and things like that. And I just wanted something, some heartwarming, good vibe, happiness to come from this. from me. Mm. So that's what I wanted to work on and put out into the world, because it's been such a weird time, and not all bad, but there has been a lot of bad. You know, I have to look at the good part of it, which is I do get to spend more time with my kids, and, you know, it's fun to not pack their lunches, but to make lunch for them here, you know? But it's also, there've been a lot of struggles as well. So I wanted some.
Now, some of your kids must be old enough now to read your books.
Yes. So my oldest is 18 and my youngest is 11. So they have not yet, but my 18-year-old said,
really?
Yeah. Well, I didn't let them read my first two books because I definitely felt like if they were movies, they would have been rated R. And so I thought, maybe not. But my oldest did say, can I read Lila again? And I said, absolutely. And she, like me, she is an avid reader, and she has like a, I don't know, I'm going to call it a 3-foot stack of books in her room, in her TBR pile, her to be read pile. And so Lila again is in that pile.
Oh.
But she's working her way methodically through her books. Yes. Yeah, so she'll get to it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm curious how she'll respond to it.
Yeah, me
too. If
she'll
see, you know, if she'll see you in some of the characters, if she'll see herself in anything.
Yeah, I don't think she'll see herself in any of it. I don't even know if she'll see me in any of it, except maybe like a younger version of me which she wouldn't even remember because she was a baby. But when you know, 4 babies at home, because gosh, my oldest was 6 when my youngest was born. So I had a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a baby. You know what's crazy is I didn't even think I wanted a big family. And after having my first daughter, I was so madly in love with her. I thought, oh my gosh, I could have 10 of her. And my second daughter was such an easy, easy baby and just such a snuggly little love bug that I thought, oh, one more would be great. And then we had my third daughter, and she was colicky and she couldn't sleep, and we were moving, and it was completely crazy. And I mean, I was like picking out paint for the new house and breastfeeding and entertaining 2 toddlers. And yeah, somewhere along the line, I thought, yeah, 4. Okay. Yeah.
Well, and congratulations.
Thank you. And I must like chaos, because yeah, we've got 4 kids and 3 dogs, 2 of which are like 90-pound beasts, but you know, it's all good.
Yeah. Oh, I love big dogs. So yeah. We're almost out of time. Just one real quick question. You said your first book you didn't get an agent for. What did you do with that? Did you ever try and resuscitate that book, or still in a drawer?
No, I did. I was not willing to let that one go because I believed in it, and I would say that I gutted it and completely rewrote it, and it is now called Maybe Someone Like You, and that was my second book that was published.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah, so that did work out.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and we usually close with a quote that my mother comes up with, but this time I found one on friendship because I feel like that's really kind of what your book is about.
Yeah.
And it is, a day without a friend is like a pot without a single drop of honey left inside, from Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that.
So thanks so much for being with us, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for having me.